Christine from Nashville, Tennessee. This is Keep Asking, the weekly podcast that helps you dive in a bit deeper and wider into the research providing insights into today's church and culture. Hey guys, great to be back. Scott, have you been doing any cycling lately?
I have not. I've been at band competitions on Saturdays, so that's my normal day to be out riding.
Okay. How about you, Casey? What's your fitness?
I have not been doing any cycling lately.
How about recycling?
Yes, that's it. Well, how are you guys doing with Pokemon Go? What levels are you on?
Is there a zero?
There is a zero.
And I'm on level zero.
How about you, Scott?
I've not even started. I've driven my son several places to do a little Pokemon, but
drive him so he can go buy Pokestops, or you get him to a location, then you make him walk around.
He's out of the little Pokeballs, and so you know, even if he encounters something, you got to go to one of those places to actually get more of them.
So, would you actually drive some of us on our team around to do that? Because Nashville, downtown Nashville, has a lot of Pokestops, but you can't drive yourself and do that.
But the intention is for you to be getting exercise.
It is actually, yes.
It just happens to be I didn't want my son crossing a 4-lane highway to go to the Pokestop that's closest to our house.
So, okay. Is it a grandmaster at this point that they, once you get up as high as?
My Pokemon level is embarrassingly high, which I'm not willing to put. No, I don't know that I'm really willing. Okay, 31, which is, if you know anything about it, it's
I don't.
It's embarrassing. But
so you've taken over the gym at your church.
Yes, I've taken over several, and I do have a few Pokemon that are so powerful, like it can squash Pokemon almost immediately. And I do have one. If you guys have you seen the one that's like the three eggs on top of a pineapple? Have you seen?
No, I can't say I have.
Okay. It's like, there's egg in the name, and in recognition of our former executive director of Lifeway Research, I've named it Egg Stetzer.
Very nice.
So you get to rename them. Anyway, but that's been my kind of fun thing. Pokemon Go has been, something getting me out walking. It keeps my mind going, so I'm not thinking of other stuff, and it's been really fun. And I've been able to hatch a lot of eggs, which I was told by my friend Amy Whitfield when we were walking. She said, please don't yell that out loud when we're walking. So anyway, getting us back on topic, we encourage everyone to tweet your questions about research, about some of our topics, and our colleagues have been great to jump in with a few. Barnabas Piper, who works here at Lifeway, does a podcast with Todd Atkins, 5 Leadership Questions, great podcast to check out. He asked a question, I think, that ties in with our last podcast. How can people learn how to interpret data since stats can easily be manipulated to say all sorts of things? So I think that ties in with the whole purpose we want to have the podcast, but also paying attention. In the last podcast, it's paying attention to stats, but then here, how do you use it? Any quick tips tying in with the last one or what we're about to talk to today about just one thing?
You know, today we're going to talk about question wording, and so we're going to talk about it more on the before we field a survey half of it, but I think it's also important afterwards. A lot of times people are summarizing statistics, and maybe you're getting a summary of a summary of a statistic by the time it gets to you, because maybe it's been, you know, a news media or whatever. So kind of getting back to that original question wording, and does it paint a different picture when you read that question wording as opposed to what that summary said at the end of it?
Most statistics are actually just percentages, so they're really not that complicated in and of themselves. But as Casey just mentioned, making sure that you understand the exact wording of that question is going to be your best ammunition. Because a lot of times if people are comparing two studies, the questions were actually asked differently. And so the numbers won't match between those two studies. And so whichever question is closer to the point that needs to be made or the topic of discussion is actually going to be the better question to inform that. And to just make sure you understand what that percentage is that agree, that disagree, that say they do it, that say they don't, is going to be the most helpful thing as you jump into that conversation.
The one thing I thought of as you were talking was also pay attention to who is sharing the statistics. If you listen to that person a lot, and are they willing to share statistics that disagree with them as much as that the ones that agree with them? Or are they selling something or trying to get you to do something? What's in it for them? I think is just a good filter to make you pause and do that. Casey, you're raising your hand.
Yes. Another thing I just thought of, I've shared this with you all before, but when the NFL had a labor strike, they brought up, you know, you'd hear the owner saying a lot, well, the mean NFL salary is, you know, something, I don't know, in the range of, you know, $2 million or whatever. And players would be saying, well, the average player only makes $700,000 a year, and they were citing the median as opposed to the mean there. And, you know, the statistics are both true. And one, you know, in one sense, they're grabbing different aspects of that reality because, you know, the median might be more indicative of what's going on for the typical player, whereas the mean is, you know, it's got that long tail of, you know, if one player on the team is making, you know, 20 million plus, that affects the average drastically. And it affects it in a way that the owners still care about because they don't really care what's happening for each individual player. They're saying, well, how much is all of this costing me? Yes.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Pretend I'm 8 years old.
Great.
And you're explaining mean and median.
Sure.
Remember, I'm 8 years old. Mm-hmm. Pretend.
So the mean is typically what people refer to when they say the average. If there are three numbers and they're 1, 2, and 3 and you add them up, you'd say, okay, well, the average of those numbers, 1 + 2 + 3 = 6 divided by 3. So the average is 2.
I respect you for being able to do math on the fly like that.
Uh-huh. I should have picked a better example, honestly, because the median of those numbers is actually 2 as well, but that's because it's the middle number. So it didn't matter if I had picked 1, 2, and 3 or 1, 2, and 50, the median still would have been 2.
Okay.
It's the middle number of the data set.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. Keep going.
Oh, so all I'm saying is, it might not necessarily be the case that one of those numbers is being painted to provide a dishonest, you know, impression, although one of them might be, but they might just be pointing to different realities, you know, as what Scott was saying. So, you know, just being aware of what reality are they pointing to and does this line up exactly with what I'm interested in.
All right. Well, a special thanks to Barnabas Piper. We want to have some listener feedback, listener questions. We'll probably start adding as a regular segment. And again, you want to check out his podcast, 5 Leadership Questions, and also Happy Rant podcast. Though that one can be a little irreverent, so that's not an official endorsement from Lifeway Research. So now shifting and focusing a little bit more on questions. Scott, everybody can write a survey, right?
Anybody can write a survey, yes.
Yes, I mean, because we get a lot of folks who we see a lot of surveys out there. And if you have a question, and we're encouraging people, keep asking. If we say keep asking, that implies keep asking questions. What's the tension there that I'm setting you up for?
Sometimes people will ask us to review a questionnaire that they've written. And the hardest part about that is I can't tell you if it's a good questionnaire unless I know what you're actually trying to find out.
And we'd like to be clear, please do not send us your questionnaires to review. It's not that we don't love you all. We don't have time. So that's a client, you know, let's just be realistic. Please do not start emailing us your questionnaires to review. So is that too
yes.
harsh?
No, that's right. Because we don't like to jump in the middle. We want to start that relationship with a ministry from the very beginning.
Yes, what the do they very want to, beginning, yes.
What do they want to be measuring? But to work backwards is incredibly hard because you can write a question, and we learned to do that in English class in second grade or something, how to write a question that actually gives you actionable information for the decision you have to make. That's what a good questionnaire is. And there's a lot to that, that you have to understand what's involved in that decision, but you also have to understand how a respondent is going to read it and what's going to be going through their mind and how can they put the answer in their mind onto our questionnaire. And that comes with experience, knowing which questions have worked through the years, which type of questions don't, and how to get around some of those gotchas.
One of my friends, Dana Runyon, who is a literacy coach or a curriculum coach in Missouri, she's always talking about when they're writing assessments or working with teachers on how to write questions and the importance of asking the right question to find out what you really need to know. And I've learned from talking to her and what they've done that that is a really important thing that's been going on in education, a heightened emphasis for the past 30 years or so. And they really look to research to say, you know, how do, if they're writing questions, how do they write quality questions, or if they go to a source for it. I also see that in like the medical field. I see it more. I see it in business. But I see a lag or a skepticism in the ministry, in the church. Where, and I know we've talked about it, where do you see that coming from, or why is it hard to adapt, or why is there that gap?
A lot of times in ministry, we can have the not invented here mentality of, you know, somebody in another place who writes a survey, you know, how can they really understand what's happening in my church and in my situation? And so you may feel like you've got to write it just to capture what's going on right here, right now. And, you know, there's an element to where there can be some contextual things that need to be incorporated into a survey or into a question. But at the same time, as you mentioned, these are things that get better over time. And the researchers writing the questions are better at writing those questions as they have experience both in a topic area as well as a style of question.
We ask a lot when we're working on projects. We're asking the folks that we're working with, what decision are you trying to make as we look at the overall purpose of a project? And then as we start to break down questions, a lot of times we find they haven't drilled down to that yet, or it takes a while to get there, or they want to make 20 decisions. What's the importance of narrowing that down and really getting it to the decision-making point, a point where they can make a decision on that question?
Usually research is not free or even inexpensive. And so if you're going to go to the trouble of spending the time on it and the out-of-pocket expense to do a research project, you want to make sure it's something you're going to use. It's not going to be just a notebook on a shelf. It's not going to be a file that never gets read. You want something that you're going to actually be able to make decisions with. It's actually going to change your thinking. And so if you haven't thought about and articulated is probably the more important piece, the things that are keeping you up at night. If you're not articulating the things that, the strategic things that you're going to have to grapple with in the weeks ahead, then as you begin to think about what goes into that survey, you're going to have topics that are nice to know instead of topics that will actually influence some action.
One thing I would strongly recommend, and I have recommended when talking with churches, that even if they are going to write a survey and they, you know, they know what they're trying to answer, they know what questions they have, I encourage them to keep it very simple and keep the scope very narrow, maybe two or three questions, and then send it out and then take action on what you learn immediately. Because we hear from folks a lot that if a group, a church, you know, nonprofit organization puts all their folks through the process of going through a survey and then there's no action, no decisions, that's very frustrating and it gets people, it's more difficult to get people engaged. So it can be done at a very simple level if you can answer, you know, the simplest question of we know exactly what kind of decisions we can make on this. Casey, as the guy who's looking at the data, what's it like for you when you see the results, but then you look at a question and you see what are some of the problems, I guess, that you can see and are frustrating for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of times one of the things we talk about is it a double-barreled question? And what we mean by that is, are you asking more than one thing and then acting like it's one thing potentially? You know, do you agree with A, B, and C? Yes or no? If somebody says no, does that mean they disagree with A, B, and C? Do they disagree with A and B but not C? You know, there's no way to kind of parse out that information. So So sort of breaking it down into really simple questions allows you to know why did they agree or disagree. And so that can be one aspect that can be frustrating after the fact is, you know, if it's not clear and precise. One of the other troubling aspects is if it's a biased question, if it's a leading question, you know, is there an outcome that it seems like the question itself is driving people, you know, is sort of the desirable answer to that question.
Jumping in, let's talk about a really maybe a simple topic that's probably super easy to write questions for, theology. There's no trickiness there. So this is what prompted us, our theology project. What were some of the outcomes with that project, Scott, and what was challenging?
The project came to us from Ligonier Ministries, and they're a group that has already done a lot of thinking about theology and a lot of writing about theology. So it was a really good group to work with on this topic. And they really came to us with a really good research question, which is kind of, can we parse out who is theologically on the right page and where are some spots where Americans and specifically Christians are actually heretical in their beliefs? And so, you know, one of the difficulties there is trying to ask questions that are not all expecting a positive answer so that people don't kind of camp out at the agree end of an agree-disagree scale. And when we get into something that might be heretical, trying to word it in a way that it's still, we're not biasing it by it sounding bad. And, you know, this can be a challenging thing just from a question writing standpoint, as well as how they respond to them.
Yeah, I think, you know, anytime we're doing it more with statements, right? So we're making a statement, and that already leads itself to the possibility that, you know, you have an acquiescence bias there. That what I mean by that is that people are more prone to agree than disagree when they're not really sure about the answer. And so one of the ways that we can tackle that in the aggregate, at least, is by asking questions both on the positive and on the negative side. And then, you know, any one individual question, they might be leaning a little more towards agreeing than disagreeing, but we get a full picture when we asked, what was it, 43? We asked a lot of questions, you know, about a variety of theological stances that people have, and you can sort of see where are they falling short. You can kind of follow those trends.
If I was working near an elementary school, I would hold up a sign right now that said, slow children crossing, and I'm going to ask you to back up to acquiescence bias. Did I do that?
Mm-hmm.
Say it correctly? So acquiescence bias, just help me with that.
Sure. So kind of how I'd originally tried to define it there, and then I'll break it down a little bit more. So when people aren't sure about a statement, they are more likely to agree than disagree. So if I say something like hard work breeds success, right? You'd in your head say, like, that's kind of a truism. You know, there's probably times when I can say that that's true and sometimes when it's not true, and it's a pretty broad general topic. And so you probably, you know, overall you'd say, I guess I agree with that, you know, because it's, you know, it's one of those things where you have to pick a side, you know. So when instead you have a theological statement like some of the ones that we were asking, you'd hope that people aren't in that murky space of, well, this sounds nice, I guess, and I can't agree or disagree very well, so I guess I'll agree. Some of the ones that we kind of observed that with on the Ligonier data were, you know, we saw a majority of those, even with evangelical beliefs, agreeing that Jesus is the first and greatest being created by God. The Holy Spirit is a force, not a personal being. So some places where you'd say, you know, I'd hope that they have the theological grounding to be able to say, well, no, I know that's not true, so I can disagree, but instead they're sort of in that murky space where I guess I'll agree because that sounds like it could be true or not true.
And we'll have these slides in the show notes so you can see the specific data and links to some of the press releases that we've done. Scott, didn't we see this when we were testing out our church planter assessment? Is that where acquiescence bias? I'm really kind of pleased with my new phrase. But when we were trying to, you know, we would have these outrageously high responses. Yes, I'm a self-starter. Yes, I'm this. And we called it the Jason Bourne, John Wayne effect, that, you know, we had to work harder at writing the questions.
Yeah, definitely. And in that case, Well, it's true in both studies where you're describing yourself. I think it's going to be even more likely than if you're describing somebody else or an outside group. But when you're describing your own theological beliefs or describing your own ministry as a church planter, it's really hard to say, well, no, that's actually absent from my life. There's actually been studies done across countries, and across countries, some people are more likely to give an agreement answer or a yes answer than a no answer. But really, I don't think there's any countries that kind of are biased toward giving a no or a disagree answer. It's just kind of the extent to which people want to be agreeable. And the United States is one of those where we kind of would prefer to agree more often than we disagree.
So switching or focusing on the area of theology, how do you stay out of hot water, you know, when you're writing these questions? Because there can be some pretty big disagreements even within evangelical, like Orthodox evangelical Christian folks that we would all say, hey, we're brothers and sisters in Christ. How do you navigate that?
Like many topics in research, you have to very quickly get up to speed on what the issues are. And one of the most important things is to have multiple readers. So in this case, as we worked with Ligonier, they had a number of theologians who were reading behind those drafts of questions and kind of flagging, you know, well, this word, we're starting to hint at this, which we don't want to go there.
Right.
And so that's incredibly okay. Helpful. And some of it, too, is just that basic practice of multiple eyes and even those same people reading through the questions multiple times. And if you have any hesitation, flag it, note it, let's talk about it, because when 1,000, or in this case, 3,000 respondents are answering, if a portion of them are hesitating, what does that mean? Or I could answer it this way and that way. And if they're hesitating in multiple directions, then we've got a question where we might interpret the answer wrong.
When that makes me think of when we were validating the church planter assessment in Australia, and we had experts looking at the questions, and there's one where here we checking for emotional resilience, where we ask something with alluding to temper, you know, a bit of a temper, and the Australian experts across the board said that is not an appropriate question, because in ministry context, no matter who you are, the idea of having a temper is completely inappropriate. But it was okay to say. People who know me well can say I have a bit of a short fuse. So there was just, you know, one was extremely offensive and they said no one would agree to that. But the other would work a little bit better. Anything else on what we learned from how we asked the questions on this project?
Well, even the example you just gave kind of touches on something similar, but we would call it social desirability. You know, are people like, will people perceive it better if I answer this question in a certain way?
Yeah, and so with social desirability bias, you know, we'll ask some questions sometimes that we know that people are going to feel like they're a better person if they answer one way or than another. You know, if I ask how often do you brush your teeth, the people who brush them 3 or 4 times a day are going to be really energetic about answering that question. And the people who brush them once or twice a day are going to be a little bit more hesitant and might bump up that number a little bit.
Just... Wait a minute. Is brushing your teeth twice a day a bad thing? Like, is that not enough?
Okay, whatever.
Because I would answer twice a day and feel pretty comfortable.
Okay.
Okay, sorry.
That's fine.
I'm now just wondering if I'm not socially acceptable.
I feel like I grew up, you always heard in elementary school, 3 times a day after every meal. That was kind of the... I don't brush my teeth 3 times a day.
Okay.
I'm willing to say that on air. Even,
okay, but, excellent. If we can just come clean with a little transparency.
But, you know, so yeah, so in terms of that social desirability bias, how do we avoid it? Well, one of the ways we can do that is just, you know, again, by hopefully couching the question in such a way that they feel like they can answer honestly, you know, that there's not a judgment happening. Sometimes for really sensitive questions, we might even ask it, you know, we might consider what mode are we asking this question in. Sometimes those questions might be better to get honest responses online than over the phone, because if they're having to tell a live person who's talking to them that they don't brush their teeth. You know, like they're going to be less prone
to brush my teeth. I feel like now I'm feeling a little
defensive.
Lizette
does not brush her teeth.
I do.
That's what we learned from this.
Is that why this microphone smells?
No. Hey, let's not take this in an ugly direction. I feel
like we
have really lost focus. Okay, now I had a really good question, but now I feel like I need to go brush my teeth. I think this ties back with what we looked at with Barnabas's question at the beginning. How people can interpret stats when stats are being used, tying back into the question, look at how the question's being asked, look at who the sponsor is or who is doing the research, and see if you can just take the time to see if there is a motivation. And motivation can be a positive thing or a negative thing. Just know what's going on there, because if you can understand the theological family that a group is in, or, you know, whether it be broad or narrow, or the theological argument that someone may want to make, I think that will help. Casey,
yeah.
You're raising your hand again?
Yep. So again, I think that sometimes when these criteria that we've been talking about clarity and precision and whether it's biased or not, can we, you know, is it an actionable question? I think sometimes those can be, you know, we can fail them, or I guess, you know, people fielding surveys can, fail to meet them unintentionally, but I think other times, and particularly in some promotional work, you'll see surveys created to ensure a desirable outcome. You know, the researchers might have, researchers being used loosely, have an outcome in mind as they're fielding that survey. One of the examples I saw, I remember there was a question out there about, do you think that we should bomb Agrabah, which was a fictional city from Aladdin? And, you know, they're asking that kind of with the intent to hopefully embarrass some people by, you know, them saying yes or no. But one of the ways that they got after that was, it wasn't just the question wording of that question itself, but if you give them 30 questions leading up to that that are about, you know, Middle East conflict, you know, then that kind of preps them and, you know, loads them to a place where then you ask about this fictional city and they're prepared to feel confident giving an answer about it. So you know, sometimes it's disingenuous in a way that's, you know, again, with sort of malintent, and other times it's just somebody hasn't really thought through all the implications of what they're asking.
And that's I think, again, looking back to who the source is, and then also what is their record in the research that they release, and any kind of bias. Since we covered the importance of good questions in this podcast, join us for our next episode where we'll cover more about what we learned in this study on theology. We do want to hear your questions and your comments and your feedback, your nice feedback. Well, all right, we can handle your honest feedback, everything. But thanks for listening to Keep Asking, the Lifeway Research podcast. If you like what you've just heard, feel free to like us and rate us on iTunes. And we hope you'll pass along our web address, lifewayresearch.com, to your friends and colleagues. Be sure to tweet your questions and comments to us at Lifeway Research and at S. McCon, at Statsguy Casey, and at Lizette Beer. Join us next time for another edition of Keep Asking. Keep asking, learn more, and do better.